Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Berso Goodness. In this episode, we speak with Dee, a prison abolitionist working to amplify the voices of prisoners in West Virginia who have been forced to consume and use water tainted by the chemical spill by Freedom Industries back in January of this year into the Elk River. More info on that can be found at storiesfromsouthcentralwv.com. Then we'll hear another presentation from A-Radio Berlin, this time a conversation with the autonomous anti-fascist Greek hip-hop group Social Waste about their art and political struggle in contemporary Greece. More info at aradio.blogsport.de. There's a call-out for supporters of Luke O'Donovan, a resident of Atlanta, Georgia, who defended himself against five queer bashers on New Year's Eve of 2012, which sent all parties to the hospital. His trial will be starting at 9 a.m. on Monday, August 11th in Atlanta, where he faces five charges of attempted homicide in what could add up to be 100 years in prison. He and his supporters are asking people to show up and pack the courthouse in support. There will also be pre-written postcards addressed to the judge to influence any possible sentencing that might come down. Those will be available online as well. Court will be held at Superior Court of Fulton County, 136 Prior Street, Southwest, Suite C640. Appropriate court attire is suggested. More updates on this case can be found at letlukego.wordpress.com. There are demonstrations scheduled for U.S. consulates and embassies abroad. More info forthcoming on that. Whether it be for a happy celebration or the beginning of a long-term support, Luke will continue to need your help after the trial. If in the Asheville area, on August 10th, there will be a benefit and presentation on the case of the 5E3, three anarchists arrested in Mexico City accused of attacking a Nissan dealership in the Ministry of Communication and Transportation with petrol bombs, a.k.a. Molotov cocktails. The speech begins around 8 p.m. and will cover the 5E3 as well as Prisoner Justice Day, celebrated on August 10th across Canada with hunger strikes by prisoners. They'll also be collecting donations to bring to the 5E3 in Mexican prison. You're welcome to bring by the following items: books and zines in English, French, or Spanish about anarchy, philosophy, and lesbian erotica. Clothing, navy blue solid color only. Sizes, women's, small, and medium. Burn DVDs and CDs, especially radical hip-hop, punk rock, good movies, and documentaries. Burned only, please. This event is a potluck, so bring some food. Also, no outside alcohol allowed.
S380847. That's my membership number in the Industrial Workers of the World. The IWW has been around since 1905, making typical unions with their bosses and bureaucrats pretty nervous. Since the stated goal of the IWW is the abolition of the wage system altogether, rather than reformist efforts to improve the conditions of the workers through means that only seem to improve the conditions of the owners and the union bosses. Unlike every other union that sought to divide the workers into trades, the Wobblies, as the IWW was called, had the ambitious program of unionizing all workers into one big union, and thereby put the power into the hands of the workers collectively to shut down the industrial production system entirely. Like the famed anarcho-syndicalist unions of Spain, the FAI and CNT, Wobblies promoted worker direct action. In the teens and early 1920s, Wobblies were targeted with charges of criminal syndicalism, sabotage, and sedition. Yeah, it was treason to demand a fair shake, to imagine power wrested from the hands of the capitalists. Still is, of course. After FDR's New Deal and the rise of the more reformist and industrial-friendly unions, like the AFL-CIO, Teamsters, and United Auto Workers, the threat and influence of the IWW faded. Between state repression and the major unions collaborating to squeeze out the Wobblies, the IWW was largely neutralized during a time when anarchists were evolving new strategies and approaches that didn't necessarily involve the seemingly impossible task of organizing all the workers of the entire world into the same union. But the Wobblies didn't go away. They didn't become extinct. They're still around and making a comeback, if you can call it that, innovating to become relevant. The IWW is actively soliciting prisoner membership, something no other union, apart from specifically prisoner unions, has attempted to do. You don't see, for instance, the UAW or Teamsters organizing prisoners, even though you've got Honda workers at Mansfield Correctional in Ohio, as just one example. There's been a trend over the last 20 or 30 years for corporations to outsource production to prisoners who receive slave wages and lack the health and safety protections enforced in the so-called free world. That's one of the driving engines, by the way, of the prison boom and the incarceration boom. Cheap labor, leaving everyone else sleeping in their cars. Prisons are now third world colonies, fenced off and ready for exploitation. Why move a factory all the way to Mexico or India when you can take advantage of slave labor in Alabama prisons? Apart from simply keeping the repression machinery of the state operating, and thereby allowing the state to ratchet up the repression, the Green Scare, the crackdown on protesters as terrorists, prisoner labor is now an integrated component in the global economy. As an indication of just how essential prisoner slave labor has become, in an Each One Teach One interview with Anthony Rayson of the South Chicago Anarchist Black Cross Zine Distro, I mentioned that if Ohio prisoners simply laid on their bunks for 30 days, the state's entire economy would collapse. It wouldn't simply disrupt the prison system. It would tank the state's entire economy, and it wouldn't recover for a decade. In 2008, a year after I made that observation, the state attempted to get me transferred to Supermax. So, if there was any doubt about my assessment of how critical prison slave labor is to Ohio's economy, the state's reaction certainly confirmed I was right. But prison authorities can't legally punish union membership. The U.S. Supreme Court in Jones v. North Carolina Prisoner Labor Union Incorporated made a distinction between membership, which is protected, and union activity among prisoners like striking, which is not. And this is where the Wobblies can become very effective at consciousness raising among prisoners, educating and radicalizing. Everyone can be a Wobbly. And once all the prisoners are Wobblies and act collectively, it's too late to put the proverbial poop back in the donkey. The state can shoot us to death, but it can't shoot us back to work. And they can't put all 3 million of us in Super Duper Max either. You know where 3 million Wobblies sit? Wherever in the hell they want to sit. If you have a friend or loved one locked up, or you just want more information, contact the IWW at 773-857-1090. That's 773-857-1090. Or email them, ghq@iww.org. You can snail mail the IWW at P.O. Box 180195, Chicago, Illinois 60618. Membership for prisoners is free. Wherever there's exploitation, let's grind it to a halt. This is Industrial Worker of the World X380847 at Ohio Supermax Facility. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain number 243-205 OSP 878 Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. We're speaking with Dee. Dee is an activist from West Virginia who's been working around coal issues around the state and recently focusing on the lasting impacts of the Freedom Industries spill of coal cleaning chemicals into the Elk River of last January. In particular, its impact on people jailed in the South Central Jail in the capital of West Virginia, Charleston. Thanks for coming on, Dee.
Thanks for having me, Burst.
Can you talk about the spill? What exactly happened, just briefly, and how the authorities initially reacted to it?
On the late night of January the 8th into January the 9th, a chemical called MCHM, which is a chemical that is used to clean and process coal, was leached into the Elk River 10 minutes from the West Virginia American Water intake facility. So thousands of gallons of this pretty unknown chemical flooded into the intake valve for 300,000 people's water. As soon as this happened, we don't really know how long the response time was from when the spill happened to when authorities and Freedom Industries informed the public of the spill, but there was an immediate do not drink order that was listed for 300,000 people through 9 counties in southern West Virginia. Probably most apparent and pressing was the largest city in West Virginia, Charleston. In my regards, the reaction from the state and corporate forces in these areas was corporate pretty immediately went into an apology mode, didn't give us a lot of answers and wasn't clear with the fact that these storage facilities hadn't been inspected for over 20 years and hadn't been clear of a general lack of oversight and responsibility from regulatory forces as well as them, the corporation themselves. State response was, as usual in times of crisis, pretty lacking. There was some emergency water infrastructure, but that infrastructure was generally shoddy and unorganized and also had limits to how much water people could take a day, which really ran into problem with large families here in West Virginia.
Part of the response that came up in reaction to this and in the failings of the state infrastructure was the water hub, right? Can you talk about that really briefly?
Yeah. The West Virginia Clean Water Hub started the day that the spill happened and initially was just going to serve as a Facebook page that connected people who were giving water to people in these non-affected counties who needed clean potable water. This evolved pretty quickly in the coming weeks as a all-volunteer coalition of different organizations throughout southern West Virginia who was working together to create alternative potable water and to deliver this potable water all throughout these non-affected counties, specifically in Boone County, where we reside in Wattsville, as well as the city of Charleston.
There's a centralized population in Charleston, as you mentioned, but there's pretty wide distribution of other people that might have difficulty getting a hold of the water, right? Can you talk about some of the issues that might impact someone's ability to get a hold of what was even being distributed by the civil authorities?
Yeah, absolutely. And recognizing the geography of here in southern West Virginia, Charleston being an economic center, most of these areas are in extremely rural places throughout southern West Virginia. They're packed away deep into the holler, miles and miles away from the nearest town. So when there were these few monolithic institutions like Walmart and Kroger having this very limited amount of water, and big water distributions were happening in only a few of the larger towns in this non-county radius, people, especially people with disabilities or with low income who for whatever physical or economic reason couldn't get out to get these fresh water, there was this large population of people who were forgotten about, the old, the poor, the disabled, and there was no infrastructure to support and provide and stand in mutual aid with these people. So the West Virginia Clean Water Hub was built on the fact that we will come to you and bring you water because not everyone can get out of their house and go get it.
You said a little earlier that you kind of weren't surprised about a lack of follow through with the authorities in relation to the accident and the impact, the lasting impacts of the accident. Can you talk about what after the initial call for no drinking and providing some water resources to the general population, how long there was actually a state of emergency that was called, right?
Yes.
How long did that last, and what sort of testing went into making sure the water supply was okay afterwards?
Yeah, it started with a 5-day do not drink order for all of the non-counties affected. This state of emergency called by the governor started to be lifted in various places on day 5 of the chemical spill and was throughout the county in day 9. This lifting of the do not drink ban was also coming around as more science was coming in on MCHM, the principal chemical in the spill, that the units of measurement to study its toxicity was being measured on 1 in a million levels instead of what science proves now that it should be measured at in parts per billion. So the level of it being potable and the safety of this contaminated water was not really apparent until weeks and weeks after this chemical crisis, weeks and weeks after the do not drink water had been lifted, and like weeks and weeks after state agencies and organizations like FEMA stopped providing clean potable water to people.
Who is West Virginia American Water? What's its relationship to the local government around Charleston? And also, how did it react in terms of its customer base and the flushing of the water system?
West Virginia American Water is a private company that was contracted out by the state government of West Virginia to provide water to the nine counties that were affected by the chemical spill. They are a for-profit company that bidded for the ability to provide this water. Their flushing process, they were pretty in the dark and had not experienced a crisis like this, where they informed residents to flush their pipes for a few hours, where we're learning now that the time to flush these chemicals, especially out of metal piping and PVC piping, is significantly more than we thought in the initial stages of this crisis.
And there was kind of a crisis on the consumer end afterwards, like an economic crisis around it, right? Can you talk about the billing for that?
Yeah, there was wide-reaching reports of West Virginia American Water charging people with three-figure water bills when they had literally not turned their water on for months, with the exception of flushing toilets. Like, almost all water use for a majority of West Virginians in this non-county radius was non-existent for the January month of the chemical spill, and a little bit more so, but still very small in the month of February. This shows a pretty intentional effort to gouge people on the price of this water by new made-up fees and new ways to quantify what water use looks like in this non-county radius.
It's pretty crazy that the authorities at all levels of government would allow for, like, basically this corporation and federal oversights and state oversights mistake and the polluting of this human right that people have, which is now being decried in Detroit, where there were people who were having, like, under threat of having their water turned off, like, and the UN actually stepped in and said, like, actually, this is a human right. People have to be able to have access to water. That the government at these levels weren't holding Freedom Industries accountable for the cleanup, or putting in their own money to A, pay for the flushing, or B, do more extensive testing. Can you talk about why that is? Why that happened that way?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's really two key points to make on this first. And really, A, is the historical context of poor people, and more specifically, poor people of color, and governmental and corporate response to natural disasters and chemical crises all throughout the United States and all about the world. There's a great and pretty consistent level of mismanaging these crises, because quite frankly, these institutions that are here to provide for the people in these communities have a blatant disregard for poor people and for black people. And I think the second trend, and more about the economic impact of what companies like West Virginia American Water is doing, is it's this large couple decade story at this point of the commodification of water and water turning less and less into basic human right. And companies like Nestle on this micro scale and West Virginia American Water on this minor scale of changing water from being a human right into being just another capitalist commodity that can be traded and that is just another right of folks who believe in private property.
So let's talk about the South Central Jail. How many folks are housed there, and what sort of crimes have they been convicted of or being held for?
So the official carrying capacity of South Central Regional Jail, South Central Regional Jail is located in Charleston, West Virginia. It is the jail that houses all county prisoners from Kanaw and the surrounding two counties. It is supposed to hold around a little over 300 people. The number fluctuates on how many people is actually in this facility to on its lowest point in the high 300s and at its highest point around 700 or 750 people. So there's a chronic and gross overpopulation problem within this prison.
And I guess in correction to the way that I asked that question, I specified people who had been, in terms of crimes, had been convicted, but these are also people that are being held there under suspicion of crimes, awaiting court dates, or what have you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really diverse set. There are misdemeanors and felonies and federal inmates and even an ICE detention center all within this facility. This is a stopping ground where almost every person arrested in this 3-county radius does at least some amount of time in this facility.
How did the spill impact the folks that were jailed there?
Well, giving just a geographical understanding, this jail is in the middle of Charleston. This jail is 15 miles away from the uptake center. This is one of the first places that was poisoned by this chemical spill. And the realities of jail is extremely different. And the reality is that these people had no other recourse for this poison water. From all the understanding that I have, people were not told of this crisis until late in the evening on January the 9th, which is about 12 hours after it was initially reported. This transition to all water being turned off at South Central Regional Jail, which people were not able to take showers or flush their toilets or all of these basic sanitary needs for the first 48 hours of this crisis, as well as varying reports of people getting anywhere up to 12 ounces to 48 ounces of water in a day, even on the high end, is far below needed hydration levels for adults. And this process lasted for 5 days of these people getting inadequate amounts of water. People pretty immediately, because of their initial access to that water, started to complain of things like skin and irritations and nausea and all these other symptoms that was grossly mishandled by the medical staff at South Central, which I hope we can maybe get more in depth in later, as well as people not having basic sanitation rights and privileges.
And has the administration been upfront about what they're providing?
Absolutely not. Once stories from South Central started to visit inmates in jail and started to chronicle the experiences that inmates were having in this facility, the jail authority at South Central wrote about how there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of gallons that were being brought to the inmates in that jail, as well as inmates getting, and I quote, warm sponge baths from the correctional officers, obviously none of which has happened.
What happens when an inmate there reports that they're spitting up foam, or they're vomiting blood, or that they're an incredible like body length rash, or you know, showing some sort of like health concerns after the spill happened? What happened to those prisoners and their petitions for medical aid?
So again, my answer is going to have to be multi-pronged. First, in their primary way of quelling people's concerns about their health was just misinforming of their symptoms. People were told that their rashes were because of they were allergic to laundry. At one point, an inmate was even told he was allergic to jail. And on the other end of it, there's a really cruel system in South Central where if you call for more than 3 sick calls, and these sick calls cost money anyways, and it begins that you have to pay money to see a nurse in this facility. But if you call for three of these sick calls in a week, you are put into medical isolation, and medical isolation, as inmate Roberta Stewart refers to it, is worse than solitary confinement, that you were held by yourself with no rec time until you're seen by a doctor. In Roberta's case, took more than 2 weeks, but generally takes days and days before these people who have valid and serious medical concerns are ever seen by a doctor.
Wow, 2 weeks. I mean, it seems like if if someone had a serious health concern, they might need to see a doctor before 2 weeks was up. And also, if they're alone and have something that's concerning them enough to send for medical help over and over again, that being alone might actually give the opportunity for whatever it is to get worse and kill them.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a baseline of ethics and there's a baseline of medical care that has to be expected for everybody who lives on this planet. And the medical staff at South Central Regional Jail is not providing that baseline of medical support.
So you were doing water distribution work in surrounding areas in those nine counties, along with a lot of other people offering, as you said, mutual aid. Can you talk about the initial moment when y'all who were doing the water distribution started thinking about the fact that there are people being kept in cages?
Yeah. I was with my friend and colleague Jonathan Sidney, and me and him were driving up to Williams Mountain in Boone County to deliver water. And Jonathan asked me, like, have you heard anything about what was happening in South Central? And I just looked at Jonathan Sidney and was like, I haven't thought about it. And then immediately it was this light bulb moment for the both of us, and I think everyone in the campaign, recognizing that, like, we were playing into that dynamic of, like, we were also not thinking about these human beings who were locked and didn't have any ability to ask for recourse to this crisis, and recognize that to some degrees, and especially as me as, like, a prison abolitionist, that this obviously had, giving these folks agency and working with people incarcerated at South Central had to be one of my primary concerns in the work that I'm doing right now.
You mentioned the phrase Stories from South Central. Can you talk about the project and what y'all are doing?
Yeah. So Stories from South Central is and primarily as an idea has started as a website, storiesfromsouthcentralwv.org, that is designed to take the letters that inmates have written us, recounting the water crisis, recounting their experiences at the hands of correctional officers and jail authorities and other inhumane treatment within this facility. And we want to build an online platform for these prisoners to tell their stories in their own words and to shine a light on the condition of South Central Regional Jail, and hopefully this expands to jails and prisons throughout Appalachia. But I think more of the crux of the work that we're doing right now is based off of that more traditional idea of prisoner support. We've talked to over 100 people, but we're pretty full-time talking or supporting around 60 inmates, most of which in South Central, some who's been transferred to other facilities, keeping a jail support line open, visiting people incarcerated, writing letters back and forth, generally creating these support networks and creating these systems of mutual aid for a portion of the population that is so often forgotten about here in West Virginia and the world at large.
Have you, in the relationships that you've been able to build, because it's a jail, even though it does have some federal and immigrant detainees being held there, have you been able to, like, actually interact on the outside with people after you've been exchanging letters or doing visits and then they come out? And have any of those folks had the time or opportunity to get involved in the project?
Yeah, So this our ability to begin this project was talking to an anonymous former inmate at Printer, which is one of the communities that we've been supporting during the water crosses, who had just gotten out of South Central. And by talking to him, we began to catalog these names. And as people came out, they still came in contact with us and gave us more names of people to see. And the second part of that outreach was our friend was actually incarcerated in South Central for over a month for more traditional political activism. And at that time, he met people in South Central and built connections that we were able to use later on to start compiling names of people to see. And I think it tells and teaches a really important lesson for people in ecological defense and other direct action movements, that jail support while you're inside and not this traditional idea of supporting political prisoners and political activists, but supporting people incarcerated no matter the context is how you build power, and this is how you make relationships in which we're able to challenge authority.
That's great. And so the view of the project, and it was kind of catalyzed by the water crisis there?
Yeah, the water crisis was the catalyst for us to begin to look at the conditions of South Central Regional Jail and accountability and recourse and a legal reward for damages incurred by these inmates are definitely still high on our priority. But this was just opening the door to see the really rotten treatment of inmates by the jail authority at South Central. And South Central, by almost all inmates' account, is a particularly egregious jail where particularly egregious human rights violations happen, unfortunately, pretty on the regular.
Do you have any, are you taking active steps towards helping facilitate class action lawsuits or like individual inmate lawsuits, or like, and would those be held? Those would be held outside of the avenues available to those jailed within there, right? It would be like in outside courts, I would imagine.
Yeah, and quite frankly, the process into finding adequate representation for inmates at South Central has been a slower process, and we're still in the process of having meetings with lawyers and trying to see what lawyers in West Virginia who are willing to really make a commitment and like sacrifice to representing people. But we're trying to consistently categorize and write down all the information that and all of people's experience, trying to keep good records and notes. So when, if that time ever comes, and hopefully it comes soon, for legal recourse for these inmates, everyone who's been in this project will be prepared and ready to move forward.
So you're soliciting lawyers at this point who can do pro bono work?
Yes.
Are there other resources that this project needs, or
yeah,
other ways that people who aren't necessarily in the area can get involved in helping out?
Absolutely. I think there's always a few things that you can do. I think primarily one of the things that you can do is you can contact us on our website at storiesfromsouthcentralwv.org to find a pen pal and help us in this really enormous task of staying in contact with people currently incarcerated. There's an online petition that is lobbying the Regional Jail Authority and other oversight committees associated with South Central Regional Jail to address concerns raised by inmates. You can also find that petition on our website. And honestly, and this is not always the most pleasant thing to ask for, is this project costs a large amount of money. We are traveling an hour to the jail at least 3 to 4 times a week. We are occurring 3-figure phone bills weekly to take all the calls that we're getting in jail. We're a project where it's absolutely invaluable for us to like consistently be spending money. And you can go to Stories from South Central WV or rampscampaign.org and donate money to Stories from South Central. It's a project that really needs consistent funding and really needs the support of like your listeners and people out there.
Can you talk about the costs? Like who handles the phone system for West Virginia prisons and jails, and what sort of costs do you expect to see for a phone call?
Yeah. So there is an organization called Global Tel Link that controls all of the phone facilities and capabilities throughout all the jails in West Virginia. It generally costs, but depending on if it is a local number or not, anywhere from 85 cents to $1.75 a phone call. This is really a pretty astronomical total for a 15-minute phone call. We're taking generally at least 20 to 25 phone calls a day. And this money is not going into infrastructure that's making these jails more sustainable and more healthy for the people that live there. This is not improving prisoners' life. This is not like even going back into the state, which I don't think is a valid way for this money to go. But this is going directly into the private corporation Global Tel Link's hands, and we're really blasting through, and these rates are really jacked up. And for people who don't have a support network and stories from South Central, this really cost gouging by these private companies are not allowing people to talk to their family and friends while incarcerated. Yeah, so generally in a week's time, if we take 120, 150 calls a day, that's winding up where we're spending $200, $250 a week on phone calls.
More info can be found at storiesfromsouthcentralwv.com.
So we're in Berlin, it's July, and next to me is Social Waste from Greece. Thank you for taking time to talk to us. Maybe we can give a short introduction, say hi.
Okay, thanks for inviting us. I'm Leonidas, by the way.
I'm Yanis, hello.
I'm Yoros, hello.
And I'm Chris.
Yeah, Social Waste exists since the 90s. So you have been there in the beginning of the hip-hop movement in Greece. Can you tell us how hip-hop developed as a subculture?
Mm-hmm. We consider ourselves as members of the second generation of actually hip-hop bands in Greece, because the hip-hop culture and rap as a music came to Greece in the late 80s, early 90s. With members with people that used to be fans of hip-hop, so they used to be listening to American hip-hop, sometimes not even understanding fully the lyrics, but trying to translate and talk to each other and try to understand what this thing is talking about. So they were inspired by the socio-political dimension of the music. And then they tried to do the same in Greek. In the beginning, they tried in English, actually, because they thought that it would be too ridiculous to rap in Greek. Slowly, they formed some kind of collectives that they used to be working together. They started doing it in Greek as well. So from that, the first generation of hip-hop bands was born in Greece, with bands like Active Member, FFC, TXE, and a few others. And then we also learned hip-hop through these bands. So the first bands that started to do hip-hop in Greece, so we started as fans as well. And then we got together, we tried to see how we could also do that kind of music. And we were attracted mostly by the lyrics and the power of the word of hip-hop. So we learned also in the same way, some of us, some others who were closer to these first hip-hop bands learned also directly. We as people from kids from the periphery of the country, mm-hmm. we were not in the capital, we learned from distance and by ourselves, basically. So there was a self kind of teaching process involved. And since 1999, we also are doing our own music and our own rap. The truth is that till 2005, we were active in the scene. Then after, for different reasons, for reasons of studies, of traveling, or whatever other reasons, we were a bit inactive until 2 years ago that we started the project again, and it keeps on going now.
Okay. How would you describe the role of political and independent hip-hop in today's society in Greece?
I think that the hip-hop bands that write down social political lyrics in Greece are not so many. Maybe there are two or three, including us. The most of them make a little bit mainstream hip-hop, like battle hip-hop, I'm better than you, etc. And some other groups write lyrics that they think that they are political, but in my point of view, they are not social political lyrics because they use some slogans from the walls, like the politics are corrupted, or the politicians are corrupted, or the government is corrupted. And they put these kind of slogans inside a trunk, a song, and they think that is something political. For me, social political lyrics have to educate the crowd. So I think that in Greece, on the one hand, we have this situation of the crisis, of the problems, etc. And on the other hand, we don't have so many hip-hop groups that supports their songs with political lyrics.
So you understand your work in giving people an analysis of what is happening?
Yeah, we try to do that. And we do that through international history, you can say. We use and we talk about some subjects about Latin America, etc. And we compare it or not with the Greek situation in order to make the crowd think about some things. Yeah.
Also, you are using real instruments to make your beats, and you have a lute you play live in the show. What would you say are your musical influences for the beats?
The hip-hop is made by the beat, the bass and the loop, these three things. So we keep the beat, we try to play the bass, and then we have the music, the loop, the music phrase that uses a hip-hop song. These years we try to play these phrases because it's easy to find a phrase from a song that you like, so you have something like a
library,
like a library of sounds that you like, of melodies. But this is just to be around to your lyrics. If you have a lyric and you want to take it out with your own style, you have to put your own music. So now we don't try to find from music that already exists, but we make our own music. We try to use, to play some instruments like guitars, accordion, Cretan lute,
mandolin.
Bedir, mandolin,
bass,
clarinet, many things. So we are experiment on the music, and then we have our own personality, and then we'll find our way. We don't know exactly where are we going now, musically.
Yeah.
We are hip-hop, we keep on hip-hop, but hip-hop, you can use every sound, every music.
Do you also collaborate with other musicians for making beats? Do you have other people playing instruments for you?
We have a lot of friends that help us with their instruments, with their knowledge in music, with their opinion.
We collaborate not only with hip-hop musicians. We also collaborate with, for example, with traditional musicians from Creta, who play whatever, the lute or the mandolin. So we try to have a combination of... also to have a, let's say, a discussion through our music and their music. And then
trying to connect to
connect to
roots.
Yeah.
Do you know any? Is this something other groups also do, or are you? Is this something you decided for yourself? And I mean, are there other groups who are trying something similar?
As far as the music, you mean?
Yeah.
Quite famous group in Greece called Adipina. Use all these kind of instruments and violin,
bagpipe,
and the main member of them, Yorgos, help us.
Okay.
The music sometimes.
He's collaborating with us as much, and we also have a common kind of project. But it's something that is being born now, so. We can't say much yet.
Can you describe your writing process of the lyrics? Do you all write together, or does one of you have an idea and you start to write parts for the others, or is it different every time? I don't.
Most of the times, it's a, let's say, a lonely kind of process, the writing part. So most of the time somebody comes up with a song, complete song, and then we work on it music wise. So we try to dress it with the music we think makes sense. Sometimes, but not very often, we have maybe half a song, somebody has half a song, and then somebody else says, okay, I know what I want to add as well, and we have that thing. But most of the times it's one of us that has the songs, and then we all collaborate on how writes the songs, and then collaborate on how to dress them musically.
So from the content, the politics is the main content you are engaged in, as I understand. What are the social struggles you're involved in at the time, directly, in Greece?
Well, right now, you mean directly?
Yeah.
Due to the fact that we do socio-political hip-hop, we are involved as a band and also as individuals in several kind of social strikes right now that are mostly related with the neoliberal policies that are being implemented in Greece, and also with the political identity that as a band we have, that is conceives itself towards more kind of autonomous movements and politics and self-managed initiatives and stuff. Also, the band is a self-managed band, non-hierarchical. And we've been involved with, for example, the water movement, the movement against the privatization of water in Greece. We've performed several times, we've given talks several times. Some other times, because we also try to give some talks before our concerts. Sometimes we, because some of us are also involved with the Zapatista movement somehow in one way or another, and we give some talks about that. We were involved with the occupation of the squares in 2011.
And the racist.
Antifa festivals and initiatives. We also published, released 2 days ago actually, a video clip that we made at the Occupied Factory, the self-managed factory of VOMA in Athens, which also can Thessaloniki. I'm sorry, which also can be found on our website and Facebook group. And our YouTube actually channel as well. So we are involved with basically most of the social struggles that go on in Greece right now. And we've always been involved. And right now, especially with the Antifa struggle, especially after the assassination of Pavlos.
Maybe you could give us a general update. What is currently going on right now in Greece? I mean, you mentioned the neoliberal policies that are more and more taking or getting more and more implemented, the whole fascist problem and the whole poverty and unemployment. Maybe can give us some update, because it's, you know, kind of hard to sometimes get a clear image what is actually happening in the, I mean, in the areas where you live. What's the main issues right now?
Mm-hmm. all kinds of issues. Since 2010, what's going on in Greece is something that hasn't happened in Europe ever since the end of the war, the Second World War. We have a recession that we have never seen it before, ever since that time. We have an unemployment rate of 30%, a youth unemployment rate of 60 or 62, if I'm not mistaken. Percent. We have a rise in suicide rates by 40% in the past 4 years. The average salary has been reduced by 30 to 40%, and we also have the rise of the neo-Nazi party, Golden Dawn. So that's also a challenge for the left, despite all the other socio-political problems. And at the same time, there is this ever-present question of social change through what means, from the grassroots, from below, or through the take of state power and through the parliament, and from the above. So all this kind of political process is now going on in Greece, and we also try through our lyrics to have a say or to influence if we can.
You mentioned the self-organization and all the I assume to do movements towards state power or towards self-organization. Is that the case? Are there like two camps, so to say, of more autonomous movements, or more movements that are more oriented to take state power through a party? Can you describe this? How would you say are the power relations in the left between these camps?
Until the end of the occupation of the squares, until 2011, September 2011, actually until the elections of 2012, we'd say that there was a tendency towards a more autonomous kind of organization in Greece. That there was a discredited political system. The party as a political instrument was also discredited and not respected, because it was seen as corrupt and hierarchical and controlled by the economic elites. But with the dissolution of the squares, although this movement was dissolved and was translated in different several different movements, smaller ones that work with the same principles of non-hierarchy and autonomy. However, in the main politics of Greece right now, general political life of Greece, what is dominant is the parliamentary kind of way to social change, with a left-wing political party, Syriza, being the main channel of of this kind of tendency. So there are also people who are advocating a kind of a middle way, what is called dual power, having a government but also the movements that run the government. But I don't really think that can work, because I don't think it has ever worked. Anyway.
Okay. Yeah. No. Please, if you want, you can share your view on this social society and state power.
No, from my point of view, the government is an instrument that is a top-down instrument that is the authority that controls the state apparatus, and it imposes hierarchically the decisions to the ones below, even if those are the movements that brought the government to power. So, but that's, I don't know, personal opinion. Maybe the others agree as well. I don't know.
We agree.
Anonymously.
Maybe about the cultural aspect in the movements. Are there a lot of artists and musicians like you who are active or trying to participate through cultural means?
There are a lot of artists that participate to this kind of festivals, anti-Antifa festivals, etc. But as I said before, there are not a lot of artists that participate to all this with their lyrics. Okay, a lot of them they agree with all this that we said before. But inside their songs, they write something non-dangerous, if you understand me. So, as I said before, the artists that are 100%, in my opinion, they help 100%. All these movements, etc., are not many.
Okay. How would you describe your own motivation? Are you trying to mobilize people who are not yet active, or maybe don't even think about political stuff, or are you rather trying to mobilize people who are actually already politicized and active? Do you know what I mean? Are you more trying to reach out to a public
that's... I think that if you try to influence people that are already politicized, basically you are preaching the choir. So it doesn't make much sense. We try to politicize people that are not already politicized. So we use our lyrics and our music as an instrument, as a weapon, let's say, for political consciousness.
You mentioned Pavlos before. Last year, Pavlos was an anti-fascist rapper. He was murdered by a member of Golden Dawn. He also was also known to speak out against Golden Dawn. Did this tragic event change how the Greek society regards Golden Dawn in any way? And did it change the behavior of people speaking out against Golden Dawn in some way?
You can tell about the assassination of immigrants. Before the assassination of Pavlos Fissas, took place some assassinations of immigrants by Golden Dawn, but no one, neither the media, talked about it. After the assassination of Pavlos, because he was Greek, and because the government decided to crack down Golden Dawn, then this subject became bigger and bigger. I don't know if the Greeks in general influenced the 100% from this assassination. For sure, they think more things about what Golden Dawn is, but I'm not optimist about the right influence.
Yeah, because also in the latest elections we had actually a rise of electoral support for Golden Dawn. From like 7% they reached 10, although in smaller numbers, because there was a smaller participation. But no, it's a matter of political consciousness, and it's not an electoral thing. But right now I'm not very optimist either. Things are bad.
Okay, so maybe one last question. You know, on tour in Germany, maybe we can share your motivation to go on tour, and maybe you have some, I know maybe you just wanted to see Germany, but maybe you have some agenda you wanted to achieve with coming here.
Mm-hmm. To begin with, we were invited by comrades from Leipzig, mainly, who are involved with the anarchist space. So our motivation was double. First, to get connected with the German movements and the anarchist space, and also to tell a story that maybe doesn't reach out to the German public through a direct presentation of what's going on in Greece right now. So we've been to 4 cities so far. We've been to Bielefeld, Göttingen, Leipzig, Berlin, and we have Bremen for tomorrow.
Yeah.
And we hope we achieved it.
So in this sense, is there something you want to add?
Yes, you can find our songs in socialwaste.org. It's for free. It will always be free. And you can learn news from us.
We've also translated all our lyrics, yes. So there are subtitles in all our lyrics.
You can find news from our website and our page in Facebook. Actually, we use Facebook because after Grigoropoulos' death in 2008, a movement in Greece started to communicate each other through social media. Because the media in Greece doesn't say anything, so we can give our informations and gather information for the movement, to the movement, through filtered social medias.
No, I don't have anything else to add. But we are glad about the interest that we see in the German society and the German movements about what's going on in Greece and the support that they show. And thanks for inviting us and for this interview as well.
Yeah, sure. I would like to express our solidarity and wish you the best and have fun in Bremen, I hope.
Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Berso Goodness.